I'm Maya Pemble, and I'll be co-hosting this episode with my project partner, Kate Brinklaw-Halver.
For this podcast, we conducted two interviews with members of the Green River Zen Center, a small Buddhist community near Northampton, Massachusetts. Through our conversations with Lily and Suzanne, we were able to see how elements of Buddhist philosophy, such as the interdependence of phenomena and the causes of human suffering, translate into practice and affect everyday life.
We hope you enjoy. Like many members of the Sangha, Lily was not raised in the Buddhist tradition. However, she'd always felt drawn to help others, even at a young age, and found that Buddhism offered a path towards her goal. Early in the interview, she highlighted an important distinction between theistic religion and Buddhism.
Buddha is not God. Buddha's Siddhartha Gautama. Like he was a guy, he did some stuff, and we really appreciate it deeply, right? And we appreciate it so deeply and have found it so useful that we practice it over and over again in the same ways for 3,000 years, because it informs our life and our practice. But there's all sorts of room for other faith traditions, which is one of the other things that I love about at least my lineage in Buddhism, is that it's not exclusionary. It's inclusive of whatever you bring to your life. Bring all the ingredients.
She recalled a moment of realization at the age of 14.
I had a moment of this instantaneous recognition that we are all one and that there is no separation. There's no evil people, there's no good people. We are all part of it. And that was a terrifying and also beautiful experience. And I cried for about 4 hours and I didn't feel like I could talk to anybody about it. I didn't feel like anybody would understand. I spent a lot of time in high school trying to find a spiritual community that I felt could understand that. I feel like Buddhism found me, and it took me a while to figure out what that was before I could find a community where I could explore that more fully in terms of what it means for me in my life and support my practice. There's no better or worse kinds of people. And so how do we collectively be, and how do we find a way to connect to each other regardless of differences?
While many think of Buddhism as a religion, it's really more of a philosophy based on the idea that suffering is inevitable, the first of four noble truths. On a superficial level, our human condition is full of mental and physical pain, disappointment by what we have, and desire for what we don't. A more profound insight of Buddhism is that we tend to think of ourselves as apart from the world, our decisions alone determining our trajectory. This couldn't be further from the truth, as our circumstances are conditioned by factors out of our control, such as birthplace, assigned gender, politics, and many others. We are not individuals, but rather beings participating in a vast network of causes and conditions. Not seeing ourselves in this way is the root cause of suffering, the deepest form of illusion. This is the second noble truth. In one of her comments, Lily elaborated on the third and fourth truths from a Zen perspective, that there is a cure for suffering, and the cure can be found in the Eightfold Path.
Suffering exists. None of us can avoid sickness, old age, and death. It's part of being. It's part of being alive. And that we increase our suffering by resisting and making stories about how this shouldn't happen and fighting it. Now, what's really important is that there is a lot of suffering that shouldn't happen. There is a lot of suffering that's horrible. And so accepting that it's happening doesn't mean that we're accepting that it's correct or saying that it's okay. It's just saying, okay, this is happening. So then I can spend my energy instead of on, I shouldn't have stubbed my toe. This is horrible. My day is ruined. I can focus instead on, okay, well, I stubbed my toe. Is it broken? What do I need for my toe? Do I need someone to help me get to the emergency room? Do I need some ice? What do I need for my toe? How do I address the problem at hand?
Another member of the Sangha, Suzanne, explained how our existence in the world is intrinsically harmonious, always in a state of interdependence and interbeing. This is a core concept in the Zen tradition and influences how the Sangha approaches the path to awakened mind.
Like if you think of a mountain, we speak of a mountain having Buddha nature because it is exactly what it is. It's exactly in harmony with everything around it. It's exactly receiving and giving in the right proportion for what it is. We don't even have questions about it. Well, if we think of ourselves and everything else in exactly the same intrinsic, balanced, right relation, that is a functioning of awakened mind. With human beings, because we have, you know, the prefrontal cortex, as well as the frontal cortex, as well as the amygdala, and of quite a complex layered brain, we're a little bit interesting because we can both have great consciousness and also great obstructedness. We can have a great open mind and receptivity and perception and relational being with, but we also have a lot of ways in which we can become quite obstructed and what we call conditioned.
As a Zen practitioner, one takes a vow to aid others on the path by remaining in the world instead of moving into nirvana. This is called the Bodhisattva path.
We're operating in the world with the strong faith that everyone is in the process of awakening. And as a Bodhisattva, we take a vow that when we personally awaken, we're not going to go into nirvana and just be in whatever that state is. We're going to come back here and continue working. We're really not going to ever abandon this world of suffering until every mind is awakened.
What does this look like as an actual practice? A major part is meditation, both individually and as a community. But the specifics of this can vary from person to person.
Okay, so there have been times when my practice has looked like how I've imagined practice would be, where I was able to get up at 5:30 in the morning and sit for 30 minutes every day and start my day that way. And that during that period of time, that I could really tell there was really a shift in terms of my sense of stability and groundedness and clarity of thought.
But sometimes that sort of practice just isn't sustainable.
So right now my practice looks like waking up when I wake up, and then I usually meditate in bed lying down. And sometimes that's in the form of using my breath, counting my breath. Sometimes it's just being aware of my body and the sensations in my body. And then I also attend the Zendo Tuesday evenings and Saturday mornings, which is a more formal sitting period. And then I'm also studying koans with my teacher, Roshi Eve Mionin Marco. And we meet usually once a week for about 10 to 15 minutes. And prior to that, I will have read the koan and studied the koan and applied the koan to my life as best as I can, and then have a way to present the koan to her that demonstrates my understanding.
Koan study is a practice specific to the Zen Buddhist tradition. A koan is a short anecdote, usually taken from conversations between teacher and student, that aims to evoke a kind of subjective clarity, challenging the mind to let go of obstructive rationality.
One of a very common koan is, if a tree falls in the woods and nobody is around to hear it, does it make a sound? The important thing about koans is that there's no right answer. It's a practice that you can engage in order to begin to uproot and shift the habitual ways that our minds work. That's one of the central ideas of Zen, is to mix it up and to stop assuming that we know anything, right? One of the central things is not knowing. And koan study is one way of getting the mind into that space of not knowing. It's not about intellectually figuring it out. It's about sitting with it, and then something arises, or it might begin to make sense in a way, but it's not about, does my brain understand it? It's about, does it resonate with my life in some way? The experience of anything we experience in the world is something that co-arises between everything that's involved, right? So my perception of what a tree looks like isn't what the tree really looks like. It's my perception based on my experience and my ideas about what trees should look like or what color is or texture or anything like that. But this is something Buddhism has known for a really long time, that everything co-arises together, right? So if a tree falls in the woods and nobody is around to hear it, does it make a sound? It's not a yes or no answer. You know, Roshi Eve, you know, she, you know, she'll remind me, this isn't about understanding it. This is about the experience of it and getting into that place of not knowing. And, you know, very often we'll be talking and I'll think, oh, I've got it. And she's like, no. The minute you think you've got it, you've missed the point. If I can come to any experience with that open-heartedness, that's a totally different way of engaging with the world than the sense of, oh, I know how things work.
While koan study is common across Zen lineages, other things set this Sangha's lineage apart.
For one, they are part of the Zen peacemaker tradition, started by Bernie Glassman.
He began a very engaged Buddhism. There's kind of Maizumi Roshi, who got both Soto and Rinzai. Then there's coming in with the message, you guys make this your own. Meeting Bernie, who went very much towards service in the community, finding out what the community needs, and then meeting those needs.
And so in the Zen peacemaker tradition, the three tenets are not knowing, bearing witness, loving action. And so the idea is that it doesn't make sense to take any action until we've firmly gotten into a place of not knowing. And then we fully witnessed everything that's happening. And then we actually take action. We don't just sit with it, we do something about it. So what drew me to Zen peacemakers is this idea of socially engaged Buddhism, that there's conversation about what are we doing in the world to end suffering, and how are we doing it? How are we doing it in this particular way? And this particular way of coming from a place of not knowing and not thinking I always have the right answer is really important to me.
It makes sense, with an emphasis on social engagement, that Buddhist practice is more than just sitting meditation.
I was exposed to Buddhist practice that was quite different from sitting meditation. And I've always thought that my practice is very much off the cushion.
Similarly, Lily describes the practice of doing her best to see things exactly as they are.
For both of them, the effects of their practice are clear in their life.
Well, the biggest ones are that I'm less reactive. So things happen around me that are harrowing or freaky or scary or shocking. And I'm like, I don't jump. I don't feel as afraid of things. I don't feel as worried in the same way. My actions and my values and my intentions and my view of what I want in the world, that's all has a lot more integrity in it. You know, immediately after I started meditating, I was like nicer with my partner. That was amazing how fast that happened.
There's a realness to that phrase, you know, somewhere a butterfly flaps its wings and somewhere else a thunderstorm happens. And so when we center ourselves in our practice, backward step into your full authentic self, there's something that happens there that affects the people around us, that then affects the people around them. There's a way in which this practice motivates me and others to collective action. There's people physically going to help or raising money. And part of that practice is the kind of collective action, like the bearing witness retreats that the Zen peacemakers organize. So there's this idea of not turning away, and there's support for not turning away. I think for me, it's a practice of like wise encountering. It's about all of us. Right? We are all engaged in this, whether we like it or not. So when we begin to understand that, there's a call to action, and we have to figure out what that's going to be for us individually. I have a friend who's of color, and we had an interaction once, and she said to me afterwards, she said, you know, I really felt like you were coming from a place of thinking that whiteness is better than brownness, right? And because I've strengthened this muscle over and over again, I could say, oh wow, I'm sorry, would you mind telling me more about what happened for you in that interaction? But in that moment, and I'm not saying I'm never defensive, but in that moment, I didn't need to be defensive. It was like, yeah, racism exists. I have white skin. I was raised in a society that values whiteness. Of course, there's times when I'm going to inadvertently stumble into that. And so what do I do? Do I say, oh, but I didn't mean that? No, that's not the point. The point is it exists. I bear witness to it. And then I figure out what action to take. That's a tiny little interpersonal piece, right? But when that happens over and over again, then collectively there's this shift towards opening our eyes and really seeing what's happening and figuring out how to collectively take action. If we understand that the earth is one body, the way Bernie Glassman always used to say is your right hand isn't going to cut off your left hand. That's ridiculous. And the earth is the same. If we really truly get in our bones that we're one body, there's no way war could happen. There's no way we would say this loaf of bread is mine. We would split it in half and give it to whoever needs it. There's an intellectual understanding of that. And then there's also times when we have experiences where we feel it in our bones and we get it and we can't ever unget it. And that's what people sit for. Historically, people are sitting, waiting to feel it in their bones.
We'd like to thank Lily and Suzanne for generously sharing their time and experiences with us, as well as the Green River Zen Center for hosting us at their practice sessions.
We hope this podcast has offered a few insights into the traditions of this Sangha and how Buddhist philosophy informs their everyday lives.